This is Beverly Tomasi, and I am really excited to welcome you to our Diabetes CDE Exam Bootcamp. This is our first class, our kickoff program. There's going to be 7 of these webcasts, and we move fast. We have a lot to cover, and we do a lot of poll questions. So fasten your seatbelt because we are going for a ride to get ready for the CDE exam. And the CDE exam is not easy. Let me just be honest. The new pass rates came out for the 2014 version, and the pass rate currently is about 65%. And so that just informs us that we want to study. We want to study smart. We want to focus on our areas that we're struggling the most with. That's where we spend our study time. And we want to take as many practice quizzes, practice tests as possible. So during these boot camps, you'll notice I'm going to put a lot of poll questions in there. And people really appreciate that from the feedback they've given me because it gives them experience and practice taking test questions, finding out which answers are wrong, and moving toward the right answers. So on the exam, the real exam, you'll notice there's oftentimes two competing questions that both seem like they could be right. And there's an art between choosing the best answer, and we'll be focusing on that a lot, and not being lured in by juicy answers. My name is Beverly Tomasian, and as many of you know, I've been a certified diabetes educator for over 20 years. I've taken the exam 5 times, and I'm scheduled to take it for the 6th time in a few years. And you may ask, why is this crazy woman taking the exam every 5 years? Well, it's because I want to know what's on the exam. I want to know the philosophy of the exam so I can share it with you. And so I don't really believe in taking an exam to pass it, as I'm sure it's very important for many of you to pass it. But the real reason we take exams is to broaden our knowledge and to be better diabetes educators, to provide the best care possible to our patients. So as we're studying for this exam, yes, the ultimate goal is we want to pass, but truly the real goal, the true goal, is becoming the best diabetes educators we can be. And as you're studying and getting ready for this exam, that might be really helpful to keep in mind because sometimes it can seem overwhelming. During this boot camp, you're going to find out areas of that are you're really strong in and areas that you need more review. And so if you're needing more review, move into that. Sometimes we procrastinate on the hard stuff. Just move right into the hard stuff and say, I'm becoming a better educator learning this information. And so that is my little coaching session, but I do have a much longer coaching session that lasts for an hour. It's our free webinar preparing for the CDE exam. It's part of your Level 2 bundle, or you can go to our website and just download it and listen to it. And associated with that on our Level 2 website, our Level 2 bundle on our online university, is a 100-question practice exam. So I'm going to be giving you, as I've mentioned, a lot of poll questions here, but there's another 100 waiting for you there. So the more practice you can get at test taking, the better. So let's get moving forward. Thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. We're going to meet for 7 sessions. All of our meetings are 11:30 to 1. I will stay offline to answer any questions. The course will be available for viewing within 4 hours of completion. So it takes some time to record it, to get it up, but within 4 hours it will be on your online university student center. And then all you need to do is log on to the online university to hear the recorded version, take the quiz, and get your CEs. And this is Susan Asensio. She's our office manager, and she's there just ready to help. If you need any assistance, here's her email address, susan@diabetesed.net. So we certainly thank Susan for all the great work she's doing to help launch this program and make it a success. So the first thing I'd like to do is just focus on, again, getting ready to take the exam. We do have a recorded webcast on preparing. We have online courses. Take as many practice tests as possible. Study what you don't know. Keep it positive. But most importantly, remember the journey. Remember the journey. Each journey, a journey of 1,000 miles, starts with the first step. That's where we're at. What to study? So this is a question I get a lot. People are kind of overwhelmed. Where do I start? And the ADA standards of care are really critical. I have that in your resource center. 2015 was a new version that's really very well written and a nice framework for our clinical practice, but a great framework also for the CDE exam. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinology has a management algorithm that you should be familiar with. It does appear on the exam, so take a look at that. This third thing I've listed here, the scope of practice, standards of practice, and standards for performance of diabetes educators, very important because it gives a philosophical underpinnings of what a diabetes educator does. The CDE examination content outline, very important. It's a nice little checklist for you. Print it out, look at it, and then see what do I know very well, where do I need to study. And then I have a screening and diagnosis of diabetes mellitus. I actually have the 2015 version on the resources website. Print that out and be very familiar with it because it talks about who's at risk and what the screening criteria is. So on that resource page that I've emailed you, we try to shove as much of the information in there that you need to help succeed with this exam. This is the Art and Science book. It's 850 pages of you know, just full of information. The first three chapters are particularly important if you're struggling with behavior change and kind of the whole, the models of behavior change, chronic care model, and so forth. The first three chapters are really excellent at summarizing those, if that's an area where you want some more resources. And then here's a review guide that has 200 questions plus. In the book, there's 200 questions, plus there's another 200 computer-based. So these two are really excellent study tools to help you succeed. And so here's what we're going to talk about today. You can see Grover is very excited about our topics. We're going to be discussing the epidemiology of diabetes, describe the pathophysiology of diabetes and insulin resistance, what is the diagnosis and risk factors for type 2, goals of care, treatment strategies. So we have a lot to cover in an hour and a half, and I will be moving quite quickly, but be reassured that you can listen to this again as many times as you want. It will be recorded. But before we launch into our next poll, I would like to launch into a poll of our own. Before we launch into our next slide, sorry, I would like to ask you guys some questions, and that is, what is your profession? And hopefully, I only have five spots, so I try to capture all the professions that might be attending this program. And if you don't fit into one of these categories, email me later because I want to know. Thank you for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. Okay. And some of you might actually have multiple roles. Many of us are dietitians and educators, or providers and educators. So I think many of us see ourselves in both roles. So I'm going to go ahead and share this with you. I've never had a tie between RNs and RDs. 42% RDs, 42% nurses, 5% pharmacists, and we've seen a lot more pharmacists entering the field and becoming certified diabetes educators, which I think is terrific. We have 11% providers, great, 11% educators. So providers and educators tied, and RNs and RDs tied. Well, there you have it. The great thing about diabetes education is that it really does require a multidisciplinary team working together, all of us coming with our different strengths and knowledge base. And so I think it's really terrific that we're seeing an expansion of who's taking the exam. And I think that NCBDE has done a really good job of expanding their definition of who can become a certified diabetes educator, which has really been needed for a long time. Okay, so let's get going and talk about what's happening as far as the global epidemic of diabetes. I'm sure you're familiar, it's not just an epidemic in America, but globally, especially in a lot of the third world countries, as they're moving on to becoming more industrialized, their rates of diabetes are going up because people are getting more sedentary and changing the way they're eating. So we have designated November 14th as World Diabetes Day to say, listen, diabetes is a big problem. Let's do something about it. Diabetes advocacy is a big part of what we do. And anytime you see a number before a slide like this, before the title of the slide, it means it came from the ADA standards of care. And as I mentioned, there's 14 standards. So this is standard 14, but I wanted to put it right at the very beginning because on the exam, they are going to ask you about advocacy. And it's true that as diabetes educators, we fight discrimination. We make sure that people with diabetes are protected. We are a part of advocating for best care and the rights of people living with diabetes. And if you are ever having a situation where people are being discriminated against because they're protected under the American Disabilities Act, you can call 1-800-DIABETES, 1-800-DIABETES, and they have a whole legal team that is volunteer basis, and they will help fight discrimination if you think your patients are experiencing that. And they also have on their website information about that. But definitely, there is prejudice and against people with diabetes. We want to acknowledge that and help you being a part of informing others that that's not appropriate. So let's go on to our next poll question. According to the CDC, what best describes the future prevalence of diabetes in the United States? And I just want to say on the exam, they're going to use this word a lot, what best or what most accurately. So they're asking you to differentiate between two possible good answers. So that's kind of a really important message of this question. Is it A, 50% of people above the age of 20 will have type 2 diabetes? Is it B, the rate of type 1 and type 2 will triple by the year 2050? Is it C, 1 out of 3 persons will have type 2 by the year 2050? Or is it D, 1 out of 2 persons will have diabetes by the year 2050? So let me go ahead and launch that poll. And then just take a few seconds to vote. All right, thank you everyone. Take one more second and I'm going to close the poll. Okay, I'm going to close that and share it with you. Thank you so much. Okay, so nobody chose the first one, which is great because it's very vague. It says 50% of people over the age of 20 will have type 2 diabetes. So we can just tell that's wrong because it doesn't have a year. And then B, it's too vague and nonspecific. B, the rate of type 1 and type 2 diabetes will triple by the year 2050. So you might want to think about this question because the rate of type 1 is gathering momentum, but not quite as quickly as type 2. So already you can kind of see that this answer is probably wrong because type 2 is growing more quickly than type 1. So actually that is not the right answer. So you may ask me, how do I know what the right answer is for this question? And you do have to have for the exam a certain awareness of the prevalence and the rates of diabetes. So you want to kind of look in the standards of care. They talk about the current prevalence, and also in the books, the art and science books, they also mention prevalence. Okay, C, 1 out of 3 persons will have type 2 diabetes by the year 2050. That is the right answer, and that's a very common CDC statistic you'll hear. So about 30 to 35% of the people will have type 2 by the year 2050. So if you got that right, great. If you didn't get it right, you just might want to, if you haven't read this answer anywhere, try and get rid of wrong answers that seem kind of extreme, and then go toward the best answer. So this is a very high prevalence, 50%. So 1 in 3 is about 33%. You could just imagine that's about right. So a lot of this exam is about, if you don't know the exact answer, trying to pull in your common sense and kind of thinking about what answer seems best. So that might help you kind of steer, even if you're not sure, toward the right answer. And so here's where we are at in America right now. 9.3% of our population has it. So right now we're at about 10%, and now we're looking at 35% in less than 40 years. It's shocking. This is important to know. 1 in 4 people have it and don't know it. And this is very important too. 37% of the U.S. adults have prediabetes, 86 million. So 1 in 3 right now have prediabetes, which is shocking. 1 in 10 have diabetes. And then here's a CDC statistic that says 35% will have diabetes by the year 2050, and they're even imagining that's a conservative estimate. So here's another question. This is more public health. Which of the following interventions is most likely to decrease the prevalence of diabetes in the U.S.? A. Encourage people to drink more red wine. B. Community-based programs that promote daily healthy lifestyle activities. C. Making daily exercise mandatory. Or D. Increasing the availability of gastric bypass surgery. So go ahead and choose what you think is the best answer. All right, thanks for voting, everybody. You guys are fast on this one. I'm going to go ahead and close this. And so I'm going to share it with you. Two answers really came out strong. Encourage people to drink more red wine. Nobody chose that, but it is kind of tempting because we know that red wine can help decrease risk of diabetes. Some studies have shown that, but you don't want to drink more than two drinks a day. But B is the right answer, community-based programs that promote healthy lifestyle activities. So we have a huge increase in the prevalence of diabetes. What is the intervention that would help the most people and work on prevention as well as deterrence of diabetes? And that's B. Some of you chose D, increasing availability of gastric bypass surgery. But if you really look at the stem of the question, decrease the prevalence of diabetes in the U.S., I think you could say, let's take it a step before they need gastric bypass surgery, and B would be a better answer to help our people be healthier overall. So, you know, that's just kind of a way you want to think is look at the stem of the question and what best matches the stem of the question to get to the right answer. Thanks, everyone. Let's keep going. Age-adjusted diabetes prevalence, this is age 20 years or older by race, ethnicity. And you can see that diabetes isn't fair. It's going to affect different populations differently. Non-Hispanic whites have the lowest prevalence, where American Indians, Alaska Natives have the highest prevalence. And there's some more additional information down here looking at some of the tribes among the American Indians and Alaska Natives, which are very high rates of diabetes. So you want to be familiar with the populations and the ethnic groups that are at highest risk for diabetes. That's really important. And also, this is an important statistic. 32% of Medicare dollars go to treat diabetes. That's just shocking that 32% of our Medicare dollars, that's $245 billion total cost of diabetes, indirect and direct costs. But people with diabetes do have 2 to 4 times greater medical expenditures, with most of that money going to hospital care. So let's talk a little bit about pathophysiology. That kind of gives us a background of where we're at with diabetes. But what we like to do right now is take a look at this organ we call our pancreas, which is so important. And if you think about the pancreas, 60% of the endocrine cells are dedicated to secreting insulin, the beta cells. 30% of the cells, the endocrine cells, release glucagon, that's the alpha, and about 10% release somatostatin, which we're not going to talk about too much for this. But we know that with diabetes, the beta cells take a real hit. With type 1 diabetes, there's really very little beta cell mass left. And with type 2, it's a gradual destruction of the beta cells. And so the pancreas, very important organ that releases insulin when blood sugars are elevated or when we eat food, and it releases glucagon when blood sugars are low to help stimulate the liver to produce glucose. So I call it the ultimate glucose thermostat, the pancreas. The beta cells release insulin. It's an anabolic hormone. That's really an important concept. It helps store glucose as glycogen in the muscle and liver. And I want to say something, that 85% of the glucose we eat is stored in the muscle as glycogen. 85%. So we keep talking about exercise. That's why. Because the more muscle mass you have, the more glucose you store, and the more your blood sugars come down. The liver also stores a lot of glucose, but I do want to point out something else, that insulin also increases protein synthesis. So insulin doesn't just help store glucose, it helps store amino acids of protein, and also it helps store fat. So insulin helps fat cells store triglycerides. It helps prevent the release of free fatty acids. Insulin is a storage hormone, helping it store glucose, protein, and fat. And very importantly, the insulin also tells our liver, don't break down glycogen. It halts the breakdown of glycogen. Well, the beta cells also release a little amylin. Amylin is another hormone that's secreted in a one-to-one ratio with insulin that causes satiety, lowers post-meal glucagon response, slows gastric emptying. And just like type 1 diabetes, just like with type 1, they make no amylin and no insulin. Type 2s make less insulin and less amylin. So kind of depending on where the patient is with their diabetes, they're going to be making less of both of these hormones. Now the alpha cells are really important. They release glucagon, and glucagon stimulates the release of glucose, of stored glucose from our muscles and from our liver. It's very important. But glucagon can cause severe hyperglycemia. So we release glucagon when we're stressed, when we're infected, when we're hungry. And that hormone helps to elevate blood sugars. So we're always trying to balance out our blood glucose levels, and these hormones are always doing this really delicate dance. I would call it a delicate dance. Glucagon is raising from the alpha cells of the pancreas. It raises the blood sugars. Stress hormones, when we're stressed, infected, raise the blood sugars. These are a little bit offline, but you can just see epinephrine raises blood sugars when we're in flight or fight mode. So we have three hormones that collaborate to raise blood sugar, but we only have insulin that lowers blood sugar, amylin that lowers blood sugar. Do we have any other hormones that lower blood sugars? Yes, we do. We have the gut hormones that lower blood sugars. So you can see there's this balancing act. And with diabetes, what happens is you make less insulin, less amylin, and less gut hormone. So these other hormones, counter-regulatory hormones, kind of win. They actually, the net effect is they raise the blood sugar because there's not enough of the last three hormones to balance those hormones out. And so it's a misbalance of these two groups of hormones. But I do want to say something interesting, that after bariatric surgery, you might notice that the blood sugars come down immediately. If a person has type 2 and they go for bariatric surgery, even before they've lost weight, blood sugars can plummet. And the reason is that they have an increase in the gut hormones. So the gut hormones are very influential at helping regulate blood sugars. And we'll be talking about gut hormones more when we get to the medication parts, because we do have medications that simulate or replace the gut hormones called Byetta, Bydureon. But anyways, getting back to this, with bariatric surgery, the level of gut hormones go up, and we'll really see blood sugars come down even without weight loss. And we might hear patients say, well, this, if I have diabetes and I get gastric bypass, my diabetes will be cured. No, that's not really the right word. The word is remission. And that is the blood sugar goes to a normal range without the need for medication. And so bariatric surgery does not cure diabetes, but blood sugars may be normalized. This is true for patients with newer diabetes and more beta cell mass. If they've had diabetes longer, they have less efficacy with the gastric bypass surgery. But as you know, as patients gain back the weight after bariatric surgery, their blood sugars go right back up. So really important to provide them with ongoing care. The American Diabetes Association does say in their standards of care, as does the ACE guidelines, that it is wise to consider surgery on patients with diabetes with a BMI of 35 or greater, especially with comorbidities. And so it is an option for our patients really struggling with body weight and other problems associated with diabetes. When the pancreas can no longer handle the workload, the patient or the person will start exhibiting the signs of diabetes. And oftentimes that thirst and blurry vision and hunger, it may not be that strong, especially in our type 2s with blood sugars just a little bit above normal. And many of our patients might be in denial about diabetes. They might notice these symptoms but think, well, I'm just getting older. That's what happens to people when they get older. And so part of what we're trying to do as diabetes educators is find those 25% of patients who have diabetes and don't know it. And getting the word out to our communities. These are the signs of diabetes. Take action if you have them. So speaking about diabetes, which of the following levels are considered pre-diabetes range? Well, it should say which of the following level is considered a pre-diabetes range. Okay, so let me go ahead and launch this poll for you. Is it an A1C of 6.2%? Yes, there is more than one right answer. Sorry about that. I had the question written correctly. Which of the following levels are considered pre-diabetes range? You can choose more than one answer. Is it an A1C of 6.2%? Is it a fasting glucose blood sugar of 104? Is it an A1C of 7.1%? Or is it a random blood glucose of 127? Okay, thank you for voting, everybody. So there's more than one right answer. And let's see what you come up with. It's fun to watch these polls because I can see you kind of choosing an answer and then changing it. So I guess the general rule of thumb is stick with your first answer, but I don't know if that's 100% true because you might have a flash and go, oh, wait, I know the answer, just like I had a flash. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. So when you think about an A1C, what is the diagnostic criteria for prediabetes? We definitely need to know this. And on your resources sheet, I did put a list of all the diagnostic criteria for diabetes and the risk for diabetes. So you might want to take a look at that and be very familiar. So A1C of 5.7 to 6.4 is considered prediabetes. So A is a correct answer. Fasting blood sugar, so a fasting blood sugar of 100 to 125 is considered prediabetes. 100 to 125. So B is also correct, a fasting blood sugar of 104. C, let's go to C. Is A1C of 7% the correct answer? No. So an A1C of 6.5 or greater is considered diabetes. And so C is the wrong answer. And D, nobody chose that because that is the diagnostic criteria for diabetes, fasting blood sugar 126 or greater. And then E is the wrong answer because a fasting, E is another right answer. Wow. Okay, wait, hang on. No, it's not. Random blood sugar 127, 126, 140. Okay. So E is not the right answer, so thank you for helping me through that. So it is a random blood sugar of 140 to 199 would be prediabetes, a random blood sugar. But that's not like an official criteria. We just know if after you eat a meal, if that blood sugar is greater than 140, your pancreas isn't working right. But that is not an official diagnostic criteria for diabetes. But after a meal, your blood sugar should not exceed 140. So 140 to 199 is kind of considered a gray zone, and we would refer to that as prediabetes. So the right answers are A, B, and E. And if you got all those right, great job. On the exam, they would probably just refer to A and B. You would need to know those two. E was just kind of a tricky one I threw in accidentally. Okay, let's go on to the next one. So here's a natural history of diabetes, and this is a great chart to study too. I actually put this together for my patients, and I go, this is so helpful because it kind of shows you the natural history. And here's the criteria for normal blood sugar fasting, random, or A1C. Here is the criteria for prediabetes. As I've mentioned here, I put the random of 140 to 199. That's not official, that's all I could say to you. But the two official ones are fasting blood sugar and A1C. By this time, only 50% of the pancreas is working. And then diabetes is when the blood sugar fasting is 126, random greater than 200, or A1C 6.5 or greater. Only 20% of the pancreas is working at this point. And you could see here, development of type 2 diabetes happens over years or decades. So type 2 is really a 10 to 20 year process, which is a combination of your genetics and also your environment. So you have the genes, and if you get heavy and don't exercise, you're more likely to move on to prediabetes. Hopefully somebody catches you here, because if you can take action and exercise and lose weight, you can move over to normal. But if not, you're more likely to move on to getting diabetes, which is a random blood sugar 200 or greater, fasting 126 or A1C 6.5%. And I do want to say this next slide is also important for the exam, that all tests should be repeated in the absence of unequivocal hyperglycemia. Like if I get a fasting of 127, then I need to get that checked again on a different day. It's usually at a different day is when you need to check, recheck it again. See what it says right here, on a different day. So you repeat the same test on a different day to verify diagnosis if it's close. But if the patient is 300 on a random, you know, and they have signs of diabetes, do you really need to verify? Probably not, but that's what the exam would say. You need to verify again on the second repeat to make sure you have the right diagnosis. Let's take a look. AJ is a 22-year-old female admitted to the ICU with a blood glucose of 476 and a pH of 7.1. What findings would make you suspect type 1 diabetes? So let's just take a look at this next poll question number 4. And that is, what would make you, with this gal, let's just take a look at her again, 22 years old, blood sugar 476, pH of 7.1, what would make you suspicious she has type 1? A, is the patient has a history of celiac disease? Is it B, patient presents with a low HDL cholesterol? Is it C, friend tells you she has been eating a ton of sweets? D, sister has thyroid disease? And E, patient is slightly overweight. So on this poll question 2, there's more than one right answer because it's more of a case study. I try to make my poll so there's only one right answer, but sometimes for learning I actually expand it, that there's two right answers. So here there are two right answers that you could choose from. What would make you suspect type 1 diabetes? All right. Thank you for voting, everyone. I'm going to take one more second and then close the poll. Okay, poll is closed. Thank you. If you didn't have a chance to answer, that's okay. We'll be going over the answers together here, and you could, you know, take the questions later on your own too. A, patient has a history of celiac disease. That is absolutely the right answer, because we know autoimmune diseases tend to cluster together, that people with celiac disease are more likely to have type 1 diabetes. That's absolutely correct. So A is right. B, patient presents with low HDL cholesterol. So I threw that in as a juicy answer. Actually, HDL cholesterol has no predictive value for type 1 diabetes. So you just want to look at that criteria sheet I've printed for you and be really familiar with the risk for type 1 diabetes versus type 2. And also, you might want to read a chapter on pathophysiology of type 1. Okay, C, that is the wrong answer. I put another juicy answer in there to lure you in. Friend tells you she has been eating a lot of junk food or sweets. Yeah, that's kind of a mythology that people with diabetes have a sweet tooth, in that maybe she has been hungry, but it's not really specifically, you know, desiring sweets. That would not be a reason we'd suspect type 1 in particular. So this is a really good point, because you could say, well, yeah, she's probably really hungry, she's got diabetes, but we're differentiating between type 1 and type 2, and both type 1 and type 2 would be potentially hungry. So that's another reason that's a wrong answer. D, sister has thyroid disease. Yes, that's another correct answer. Thyroid disease tends to run in families with diabetes. So like thyroid disease, celiac disease, type 1 diabetes are all autoimmune diseases. And if one member of the family has an autoimmune disease, other members of that same family are more at risk for autoimmune disease. It kind of clusters in families. So A is right and D is right. On the exam, there's only going to be one right answer, but I just wanted to use this as a case study to give us more opportunities for learning. But on the exam, it's just one. Okay, E, patient is slightly overweight. So overweight would make her more at risk for type 2 diabetes. So that would be a differentiator. So the correct answers are A and D. And you guys, most of you got it right. So great job. And if you didn't get it right, you know what it tells you? Oh, I need to study a little bit more about pathophysiology of diabetes. And there's a lot of great chapters on that in the Art and Science book and online and in the Standards of Care, actually. They have a lot of good pathophysiology information. So let's talk a little bit about type 1 diabetes. And this is a photo taken in the year 1921 of a child with type 1. You can see, since he makes no insulin, he cannot store fat. He has no fat on his body. If you don't make insulin, you can't store protein. He has no muscle mass. If you don't make insulin, you can't store glucose as glycogen. His liver can't store energy. His muscles can't store energy. So he is in a wasted state. He is undernourished. He has failure to thrive. This is a child who is completely insulin deficient. And in those years, they were doing everything they could to help them live longer, and they would put them on very low calorie diets, like 500 calories a day, just to sustain life. So it's such a sad picture, but the great news is this little boy made it because he received insulin therapy. And I don't have a picture of him here, but we'll meet him again in the insulin presentation. So you'll get to see him again and just be like, it's amazing the transformation he's made with type, you know, getting insulin, this little boy with type 1 diabetes. So you can see there has been a rise in type 1 diabetes. It's increasing globally, 23% rise over the past 8 years, which is really tremendous. Why? Autoimmune disease rates are increasing overall throughout the globe. And we're not really sure why, but we're thinking it's changes in environmental exposure and gut bacteria. These are all theories. We don't know for sure. But as we've eaten more processed foods and we're living in environments where we're not interacting very much with the earth, with animals, we're getting more hygienic. As we get more hygienic and disconnected from the bacteria, as you know, bacteria outnumber us 10 to 1, and those bacteria do a lot of work for us. And so we're changing our microbiome, and that seems to influence our expression of disease. And that is actually the hygiene hypothesis. We're getting so clean, our immune system doesn't know what to do with itself. So maybe it's actually initiating more autoimmunity within ourselves. Or is it we're getting heavier? With type 1 diabetes, there are some thoughts that it's the pancreas gets overwhelmed by the obesity, and it might trigger the introduction or the genetic switch on of type 1 diabetes, obesity. We never would have considered that before. So you can see these have question marks. We're really not sure. We're investigating further. There's a lot of studies going on globally. One is a TEDi study to figure out what are the environmental triggers. But if you look at the incidence in youth, the general population, very low incidence. If you have a brother or sister, mother, look at siblings high, 4%. Father puts you at a little bit higher risk. If you have a sibling or a parent with type 1 diabetes, your chances are higher than the general population of getting type 1 diabetes. So here's another poll question. According to ADA standards of care, who should be screened for type 1 diabetes? Is it A, high-risk individuals with family history of autoimmune disease? Is it B, all teenagers at puberty? Is it C, high-risk ethnic groups? Or is it D, all individuals starting at the age of 45? So this is kind of an interesting question. I'm going to launch it because we never used to talk about screening for type 1. We would say screen for type 2, but now the American Diabetes Association has recognized that we know who's at risk for type 1, and so we need to reconsider our standards and maybe do some more outreach to identify those at risk for type 1, because there's a lot of research going on now that is saying maybe we can provide vaccinations or other environmental changes to help reduce the risk of those at risk for type 1 from triggering the gene to turning it on. I hope that made sense. Okay, I'm going to close this poll because you guys are just doing such a great job and share it with you. You got it right. 96% of you chose the right answer. It's high-risk individuals with a family history of autoimmune disease is the right answer. Some of you chose D, all individuals starting at the age of 45. But that they've done actually some analysis on just testing the population. Would it be worthwhile to do at this point? Because they could do that. They have the technology to find out who's at risk. But it's too expensive to do it at this point. So they're just looking at high-risk families and identifying who's at risk for type 1. So type 1 diabetes, 10% of the diabetes are type 1. It's an autoimmune destruction of the beta cells, most commonly expressed at the age of puberty because you're releasing a lot of hormones that cause insulin resistance. They're insulin sensitive. They require a small amount of insulin a day, usually based on body weight, 0.5 to 1 units of insulin per kilogram. So these are people who would be like on 4 units of, you know, bolus insulin every meal and 12 units of Lantus at night. They're on small doses. It's relative to their body weight. Of course, if they get heavier, they're going to need more. But they're not like a type 2 who needs enormous amounts of insulin. They need just the right amount to cover for the deficiency. It's a combination of genetics and disease susceptibility. That's interesting. So you have the genetics and then you look at the environment. What in the environment might increase your risk? Well, we know that if you're not breastfed, it's a higher risk for type 1. And there's other viral triggers I've listed here. Coxsackie virus, very common activator of type 1 diabetes. So you have the gene, you get this infection, and that's a turning point for many kids with type 1 where they express the type 1, all of these viruses. So they're actually working on a Coxsackie vaccination to help these kids prevent, the high-risk kids, prevent from turning and getting that type 1 diabetes, to stop the gene from switching on. A lot of great work going on in this area. But this is the great news. People with type 1 are living longer. You know, many years ago, the life expectancy was not this great, and now the average age is 68.5. And that means a lot of them live longer than that, and some of them live less longer than that. But I've seen a lot of patients in my practice, in my clinic, in their 80s and 90s with type 1 diabetes, really having vibrant lives. And the diabetes does take a lot of work, but they're still able to keep moving forward, which is great. So type 1 versus type 2. How would we know someone is type 1? Well, if we're not sure by the clinical presentation, we tend to look at antibodies. These are three common antibodies we will draw to evaluate if somebody has type 1 or type 2 if we're not sure. But mostly we base our diagnosis on the presentation, what age, and their pH. Like Gal's pH, if you remember, was 7.1. If it's 7.1, it tells us she's burning fat for fuel and she's getting acidotic. So she's more likely to be a type 1 diabetes, plus her family history. Here's the autoantibodies spelled out, GAD, ICA, IAA. You would send these to the lab, and if one or more comes back positive, we would know that person has more of an autoimmune type 1. Here's the conditions associated with type 1 diabetes, celiac, thyroid, Addison's, rheumatoid arthritis, and other autoimmune conditions too. But the top two would be thyroid and celiac disease. I just had to put this slide in. What does type 1 look like? So there's people living, thriving, doing great with type 1 diabetes. And I just love this Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Type 1 diabetes since she was 8. And just look what she's accomplished. The other thing I do want to mention is this is from the Joslin Center, who's been doing diabetes since the beginning. And they've been tracking people who've had type 1 for over 50 years. Here they are pictured here, just amazing humans. And they found that many of them still produce some insulin, and many of them had no eye disease. And I would encourage you, if you have anybody living with type 1 diabetes for more than 25 years, they can get medals from the Joslin Center for their courageous living with diabetes. You can just go to their website and they have the application online. The other thing I have to tell you about is diabetestrialnet.org. If you know anyone with type 1 diabetes, their family members should contact, go to this website and look to see if they could be a part of this trial that's viewing the natural history of diabetes, type 1, and also providing interventions to hopefully prevent diabetes type 1 in the future. It's really worth taking a look at. So let's go back to AJ. We've decided it's because of her pH 7.1. She's burning fat for fuel. She's more of a type 1. Plus, you know, she has that family history of autoimmune disease. What baseline lab work and tests does she need? What referrals? So let's take a look. And this is a pretty important list of all the stuff people with diabetes need. They need it on diagnosis, and then they're going to need it on an ongoing basis. A1C, lipids, microalbuminuria, creatinine, GFR. They need to get their TSH checked out. We want to screen for celiac disease if they have any signs of it, and we want to see how their liver function is. And on top of that, they have to get an annual dilated eye exam, family planning, registered dietitian to help with their eating and making changes as far as food choices. They need a diabetes self-management program, dental exam, and mental health professional if needed. So these are all of the other referrals that we might consider for somebody living with diabetes, newly diagnosed with diabetes, or just we want to help them keep at their best health possible. These are resources for those, you know, people living with this condition every day. So type 1, it's an autoimmune pancreatic destruction. You need insulin replacement therapy, often first present in ketoacidosis, and we know they're at risk for other autoimmune diseases. So let's take a look at this patient with type 1 in the hospital. They're 43 years old, admitted to evaluate angina. Morning blood sugar is 92. Based on the regular insulin sliding scale, no insulin is required. But the breakfast tray shows up and the patient says, "Hey, I need my insulin before I eat." What do you say? So blood sugar is 92, and based on the scale in the hospital, no insulin required. But the patient says, "Hey, where's my insulin?" What are we going to say? We're going to say, "How much do you need? What do you usually take?" Because a person with type 1 diabetes needs insulin even if their blood sugar is normal, even if their blood sugar is 92, because they're going to eat food, their blood sugar is going to go up, they have no insulin. And so we need to give them an injection of insulin to imitate what the pancreas would do. So we assume with type 1 diabetes that they have a lot of expertise in their diabetes and they know what they need. And this is an important kind of philosophical stance for the exam, that they're going to bring up case scenarios like this. And we want to understand and respect that the patient living with diabetes has a lot of knowledge about their diabetes. And we need to honor their knowledge and also act upon it. And so I think this is a really good example of the philosophy of that. Instead of saying, "Well, the scale says no insulin, you're not going to get any," what would the patient need usually is a really good point for the exam philosophy. Okay, let's do another one. Patient is 58 years old and states she has had type 1 diabetes for 18 years. She quit smoking a year ago and gained about 20 pounds. Her BMI is 25. Here are her medications. Humalog, wow, 18 to 23 units before meals. So remember I was telling you with type 1 diabetes, they need, you know, 3 to 6 units per meal. So now we're kind of mystified. 18 to 23 units before each meal. Let's keep going. Lantus, 28 at bedtime. Okay, again, Lantus is a basal insulin, and usually for type 1s, they need a little bit less than that. So I'm intrigued. What? She's on metformin, 500 milligrams, 3 times a day. So when we think about type 1 diabetes, are people usually on metformin? No, they're not. So what tests would you recommend to figure out, is she really a type 1? or is she a type 2? Well, I'm going to tell you, this patient, this is a true story, she was cash pay, so we could not actually run any tests on her. But what I, right around that time I was thinking about this patient, I went to a postgraduate conference, American Diabetes Association, and one of the speakers said 25% of patients with type 1 also have type 2. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do want to let you know that people with diabetes can have the genetics for both. They can have the genes for type 1 and express that early in their life, and then maybe they gain weight and they have a strong family history of type 2. And actually, this woman had both parents had type 2 diabetes. So now, as she gained weight, got older, she was also expressing insulin resistance, type 2. So this is just a phenomena you're going to see, and many of these patients are put on metformin plus insulin. Let's take another look at a different patient, 72 years old. Her A1C 3 months prior was 6.2. Now it jumped up to 13.9. So this is pre-diabetes, right? 13.9 is no longer pre-diabetes. Body weight, less than 25. So we know this person is kind of considered normal body weight. And they lost about 10 pounds over the last month. Here is this person right here, 72 years of age. This is my mom. And just so you know, my mom always gives permission to bring this case study up because she's like, I want to help people understand this condition, because what we determined my mom had was LADA, latent autoimmunity diabetes in adults. Now, you may ask, why am I bringing this up? And I'm bringing it up because we've got some feedback from people who've taken the exam recently that this condition does appear on the exam. So I want you to be familiar with it. LADA is latent autoimmunity diabetes in adults. Remember how I was talking about the GAD, insulin autoantibodies, and islet cell antigen? So let me just keep telling you a little bit more about my mom. So my mom had A1C of 13.9. She was started on insulin 4 times a day. So bolus, and then basal at night. And the doctor drew a C-peptide on her. So C-peptide helps us see how much endogenous insulin they make. Well, guess what? Her C-peptide was low normal, but she was making endogenous insulin. So I asked the provider, could we look at the autoantibodies? And we did. And her GAD came back positive. So that told me she has more of an autoimmune type diabetes versus type 2 diabetes, because she's already having autoantibodies, and that she is not a type 1 or a type 2. She's kind of in between. She's a LADA, or diabetes 1.5. So what do we know about LADAs? We know that they need insulin, because we want to protect whatever remaining beta cells they have. Insulin therapy is very important within the first 6 months of diagnosis. Very important. And so just to kind of tell you where my mom is today, she's actually on insulin, but she's also on metformin. She's on basal insulin once a day, and then she's on metformin. Because as it turns out, a lot of LADAs have both clinical features of type 1 and type 2. So they need insulin for sure, but they can also have a little bit of insulin resistance, so they might really benefit from metformin. So LADA, usually they're under the age of 50. Acute hyperglycemia, like I was saying, my mom's A1C went from 6.2 to 13.9 in a matter of months. BMI is less than type 2's usually. History of autoimmune disease. So my mom's family, a lot of rheumatoid arthritis, and family history of autoimmune disease. So that's just a summary of type, this 1.5 or LADA, and it's usually older patients who are kind of lean, newly diagnosed. You try them on oral agents, it doesn't work. You see they need insulin early on. That's kind of the hallmark. And I have some resource papers on the website I've listed for LADA that you can take a look at. Okay, who's this gal? Well, this is Patty LaBelle, and she's got a lot of attitude. I love her. She was, you know, on tour, not really taking very good care of her health. She gained quite a bit of weight, and she passed out on stage. And they found out Patty had type 2 diabetes. And Patti LaBelle says, I'm not diabetic, I'm a diva-betic. That's a mix of diabetic and diva. You just gotta love her. So Patti LaBelle, like many of us, you know, was just kind of gaining weight. So she had the genetics for type 2 diabetes. She was gaining weight, probably not exercising as much as she could have. And you can see, here's the BMI chart. I really like this BMI chart because it gives you a real nice visual. And then as we get into a BMI of 30, we're moving to obesity. So 25 to 30 is overweight. BMI of 30 is considered obese. And you can see where the weight gathers. It gathers in the abdomen and the thighs. And as the waistline increases, the risk of diabetes and other heart diseases also increase. So let's do a question on BMI. Which of the following is an accurate statement describing the risk between BMI and diabetes? A. There is an increased risk for diabetes when the BMI is 30 or greater. B. There is no risk of diabetes when the BMI is less than 25. C. The risk for diabetes increases as the BMI goes down. Or D. The risk for diabetes increases for Asian Americans when the BMI is 23 or greater. I'm going to launch the poll and see what you think. There's only one right answer on this one. Thanks for voting. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. And as I'm looking at this, the way I wrote the questions, so, you know, writing good questions is really hard. So I'm going to really indulge you in being patient with me because I'm trying to find out, you know, to really present these in a way that's not an easy answer. So let me just share with you the first answer. So which of the following is an accurate statement describing a risk between BMI and diabetes? So A, 63% of you chose that. And the answer was there's an increased risk of type 2 diabetes when the BMI is 30 or greater. That is true, but it's not the best answer because really what would be the best answer is if I would have put there's an increased risk of a BMI of 25 or greater. So it is true that if your BMI is 30 or greater, you're at increased risk, but the best answer would have been 25 or greater BMI increases your risk. I didn't write that down. So I think what I was really trying to get at and is that the cutoff point of BMI starts when you're 25 or greater. But if you chose that, it's okay. Let's just keep going on to see what the answer I was really trying to drive you toward. So nobody chose B. There is no risk of diabetes when the BMI is less than 25. You're right. That's not a right answer. And then C, nobody chose that. And then 38% of you chose D. That was my actual intended right answer because it is true that in Asian American, type 2 risk increases when the BMI is 23 or greater. That's really important to know for the exam. I think it's going to come up because the ADA standards of care just changed this year, and they made a big deal about saying for Asians who carry most of their abdominal weight abdominally, that even though their BMI is 23, they're at increased risk for diabetes. And so D is the right answer, but I could see why you chose A. So D is the best answer, and for non-Asian Americans, the BMI cutoff is 25 or greater, increases your risk of diabetes. Okay, let's keep going. So who is at risk for type 2 diabetes? Well, testing should be considered on all adults who are overweight and have additional risk factors. So you just want to know that BMI cutoff is 25, and you want to know these risk factors. So these are, you know, risk factors associated with diabetes. And here's my little slide on the BMI of 23. And I put a picture here is that when Asian Americans gain weight, they have a higher relative risk of getting more visceral adiposity than the non-Asian Americans. So just to kind of be on the lookout for that. Here's some other risk factors for type 2 diabetes. And insulin resistance certainly is kind of the underpinning here, which we're going to get to in a minute. Insulin resistance is the seed. So as we gain more weight in our bellies, we're more likely to become more insulin resistant. So that visceral adiposity in our bellies causes a release of chemicals and cytokines that cause inflammation of the blood vessels that cause insulin resistance. So it's the weight gain associated with our genetics that activate this insulin resistance. And insulin resistance means the muscle cell resists insulin, the fat cells resist insulin, and so there's a lot more glucose in the blood, plus there's a lot of more fat, triglycerides, and free fatty acids in the blood. So that sugar plus the fat in the blood is what causes the vascular complications associated with type 2 diabetes. And let's kind of talk about that some more. So which of the following best describes insulin resistance? So I just kind of gave you a definition, but that's not the right one. Which of the following best describes insulin resistance? Is it lack of sufficient insulin receptors on muscle cells and fat cells? Is it B, visceral adipose tissue? Is it C, a physiologic condition where insulin becomes less effective at lowering blood glucose levels? Or is it D, excessive triglyceride? Well, I changed the order, sorry. So is it D, a physiologic condition where insulin becomes less effective? Or is it C, excessive triglyceride levels? What is insulin resistance? Lack of receptors, A, B, visceral adipose tissue, C, excessive triglycerides, or D, a physiologic condition where insulin becomes less effective. Okay, thanks for voting, everyone. I appreciate it. I'm going to close this poll and share it with you. So, A, lack of sufficient insulin receptors on fat and muscle is not the right answer. So if you chose that, it's okay. You just want to study more about what is insulin resistance. Because the truth is, with diabetes, there's plenty of receptors. It's just that the cells push the insulin away. It's really a post-receptor defect. The insulin binds to the cell, but it doesn't start this whole chemical synthetic biosynthesis pathway it's supposed to start. And so insulin will bind, but nothing happens inside the cell, or very little happens. So A is not the right answer. B was my juicy answer, visceral adipose tissue, but it's not the right answer because I'm saying what describes insulin resistance. I didn't say in the question what best describes a risk factor for insulin resistance. So if you chose that, you just want to make sure what is the key intent, what is the key stem of the question. Nobody chose C, which is great. D, 64% of you chose that. Awesome. It is a physiologic condition where insulin becomes less effective at lowering blood glucose levels. That is the best answer. So if you chose that, yay, great job. And if not, I think I have a whole chapter on insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome listed on your resources. So that chapter really does describe metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance in a very detailed way. That will be a great review for you. All right. So who's at greater risk for having diabetes and heart disease? Is it the apple or the pear shape? Well, it's the apple because the apple shape has this visceral fat. Visceral fat is not subcutaneous fat. Subcutaneous fat is that stuff on the outside that jiggles around more. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the fat that sits on the liver, that sits on the intestines, that sits on the pancreas, that's coating everything. And this fat is actually considered an endocrine organ. It's releasing cytokines and chemicals that cause inflammation in the blood vessels. So we're always trying to support people with diabetes losing weight because when they lose weight, we know 30% of that weight loss is from the visceral fat. So Oh, I can't emphasize this enough. When we measure your waistline, we're measuring how much visceral adiposity you have. And so really getting the waistline smaller helps a lot with decreasing insulin resistance and lowering blood sugars. So here's the natural progression of type 2 diabetes. Here we see 20 years before diagnosis, this person has a genetics for diabetes. Maybe their mom had type 2 diabetes, and they've gained some weight, and they're, you know, not exercising. Let's just make them 45 years old, which is the average age where people get diabetes type 2. And then what happens is they gain that weight, and they're not exercising. They become more insulin resistant. Their cells do not use insulin effectively. And then since they're becoming more insulin resistant, the pancreas has to go into overtime. The pancreas starts squirting out as much extra insulin as it possibly can to try and overcome resistance. But over time, the pancreas loses juice and it can't make enough. And you can see up here the corresponding blood sugars. As the insulin resistance stabilizes and the pancreatic insulin production decreases, the blood sugars go up. Both fasting and postprandial are on the rise until right here where we're diagnosed with diabetes. This is a 20-year process. What if we would have caught the person here at pre-diabetes and helped them lose weight and exercise? We might have intercepted this progression to type 2. But in this situation, we didn't. So right here, we're going to start exercise, losing weight, see a dietitian, and we're going to start people on what medication? Right, metformin. Now, we start them on the medication, but look at this interesting thing. Insulin resistance stays the same. Insulin production keeps dropping. At diagnosis of diabetes, only 20% of the beta cells are left. And over time, you lose even more of those. And so insulin secretion diminishes. And this slide shows me that about 30% of people will eventually need insulin with type 2 diabetes, maybe more. We're underdoing insulin, believe me. Because you can see after having it for 30 years, you're making very little insulin. That's the natural history of type 2. So if patients with type 2 need insulin, it's not their fault, it's their pancreas's fault. It's run out of juice. So when we think about type 2 diabetes, it really is associated with insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is the seed. Insulin resistance makes your blood sugars go up because your fat cells and your muscle cells don't use insulin effectively. It's that visceral adiposity that's really causing this inflammation, plus sedentary lifestyle, genetics. If you had gestational diabetes or your patients did, that puts you at higher risk for insulin resistant. If you had polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS, oftentimes women with that condition have excessive testosterone levels, and that can make them more insulin resistant. People with obstructive sleep apnea and insulin resistance is also associated with cancer. So cancer and diabetes have an intersection because many people with diabetes are more likely to get cancers, and people who are overweight and have insulin resistance are more likely to get cancers. So there's this intersection between those two conditions, really looking at obesity. I just wanted to show you a picture of acanthosis nigricans. It's a skin manifestation of insulin resistance. Here you can see the skin is thick, velvety, and dark. That is the skin yelling out. I don't know if it's yelling out, but it's saying, I am insulin resistant, help me. And the best treatment to diminish this darkened skin, and look at, here's their skin tags too, losing weight and exercising will help diminish this. This acanthosis nigricans not only happens on the neck, but you'll see it on the underarm, waistline, groin, knuckles, elbows, toes. You'll also see it many times associated with skin tags. It's a sign this person needs help. Get blood sugars down. And look at their cholesterol and their blood pressure too. There's 8 things broken with type 2 diabetes. So kind of in summary, insulin resistance is the key, and this kind of triggers other defects or is associated with other defects. We know that the pancreas is making less insulin, 80% loss at diagnosis. The liver pumps out too much sugar because there's not enough insulin to keep the liver in check. There's more free fatty acids and increased lipolysis. The fat cells are insulin resistant. There's more glucagon secretion. So if you remember, it's the pancreas that makes glucagon. The pancreas is over-secreting glucagon. It's broken. Pancreas is broken, which raises blood sugars. 85% of glucose is taken up at the muscle. With type 2 diabetes, there's insulin resistance, severe insulin resistance at the muscle. That's why building muscle, keeping muscle metabolically active is so important. 50% less gut hormones are created when you have type 2 diabetes. So decreased level of gut hormones is associated with increased levels of blood sugars. Also, there's less neurotransmission to the brain of fullness. And the last thing that's broken are the kidneys. Normally, the kidneys release blood glucose when it's greater than 180. But when you have diabetes, it's upregulated. You don't release extra sugar till it's 210. These are called the ominous octet. This is by Dr. DeFronzo. He won the ADA Banting Award a few years back. And we'll be talking about this more when we talk about medications in an upcoming class. So we'll kind of, what's broken, how do we fix it? We'll be making that relationship. So just to kind of do a comparison of type 1, type 2, and LADA, who's insulin dependent? Well, let's just start with obese. Who's obese? It's our type 2s. Who's insulin dependent? Type 1s. Type 2s, 30%. LADAs really need insulin within 6 months of diagnosis. Who responds to orals? Well, our type 2s for sure. Our LADAs might for a few months, and then it doesn't work at all, or very little. It works maybe a little bit, but they really need insulin. Who burns fat for fuel, also known as ketosis, are type 1s for sure. Type 2s and LADAs really pretty rare. Who's got antibodies? Our type 1s do, and our type 2s. They're both autoimmune condition. Our type 1s and our LADAs. Type 1s and our LADAs. Our type 2s do not. It is not an autoimmune condition with type 2. Typical age of onset, type 1, teens, during puberty. Type 2 adults, it was average age was 45, it's getting younger. And LADA is, yeah, adults, right around, I would say 30 to 50-ish is a pretty common range. But I've seen it in the 70s and 80s. Who's most likely to be insulin resistant? It's our type 2s because they are, not utilizing insulin correctly. It binds to the cell, but the cell rejects it, post-receptor defects, and that whole chemical breakdown of glucose does not happen appropriately. Diabetes is also associated with fatty liver disease. Oh my gosh, if you're obese and you have insulin resistance, you're much more likely to have little hepatocytes full of fat. So we really encourage all of our patients to lose weight, exercise. It will help not only with their diabetes, but fatty liver disease, obstructive sleep apnea. It will help reduce risk of cancer and Alzheimer's. People with diabetes are much more likely to have Alzheimer's and depression. And so, again, activity, losing weight, eating healthy helps all of these, plus getting those blood sugars down. And the other thing that diabetes is associated with is cardiovascular disease. It's no surprise we've been talking about insulin resistance. And when you're insulin resistant, you make more insulin to overcome resistance. And insulin resistance is associated with hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, hypertension. And then I made this one up, hyperwaistlinemia. So if we measure a waist and it's more than 35 inches for women and 40 inches for men, that tells us that they might have excessive visceral adiposity and they're at greater risk for not only diabetes, but also cardiovascular disease, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. So these come together. You've seen it a million times on Histories and Physical. Patient now presents with an MI, history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, hyperglycemia. Those three come together. Patient comes in with cellulitis, history of hyperlipidemia, hyperglycemia, because it is all related to that insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is related to vascular disease and diabetes. And so here's a slide that kind of summarizes the wildly high risk of heart disease and vessel disease with diabetes. There's a 3 to 5 times increased risk of CHF. You can see diabetes versus no diabetes. Heart attack, look at this. Coronary heart disease and stroke. And so whatever we can do to help people not get diabetes, you know, work on finding them at pre-diabetes, but also if we can help them to, once they do get diabetes, to really mitigate their risk factors and get their blood pressure, their cholesterol, and their blood sugar to target. I'd like to ask you now a question. Which of the following are considered modifiable cardiovascular risk factors? Is it A? I'm going to launch this. Family history and obesity. Is it B, smoking and obesity? Is it C, hypertension and ethnicity? Or is it D, BMI and age? And there's only one right answer here. Which of the following are modifiable risk factors? All right. So I could totally tell that you guys are just on fire on this one. I made this question too easy. Let me close this and share it with you. So you're right on. 100% of you chose the right answer. Smoking and obesity, because those are two things that patients can change. And when we're working with our patients with diabetes and we're looking at their risk for heart disease, we're certainly going to counsel them on helping make changes to their risk factors they can change, and really coaching them to make those very difficult behavior changes. Cardiovascular risk factors. So the more risk factors, the greater the risk of heart disease and diabetes. We used to say, you know, we have the different definitions for metabolic syndrome or syndrome X or insulin resistance syndrome. The American Diabetes Association says if they have any of these, we need to address them, because the more they have, the more likely they are to have heart disease and vessel disease. So we want to look at their waist lines, their body weight, their lipids, their blood pressure, inflammation. Think about getting them on aspirin. We'll talk about that more later. Look at their family history, their risk, and their activity level. All of these are going to feed in to increasing or decreasing their risk of heart disease. The bottom line is cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of death for people with diabetes. 65% of people with diabetes die from heart disease versus 36% in the general population. So as diabetes educators, we really have a tremendous role in helping identify who's at risk and helping them to manage those risk factors. And we'll be talking about that risk factor management next class, which is Thursday, when we talk about goals of care. And so this might feel kind of depressing for people listening to me talk about, you know, diabetes and its risk for heart disease. But look what Sherry Shepherd did. She was from The View, and she got diabetes, and again, you know, just kind of out of the blue. She kind of knew it was coming, because she had a family history. But she did not let that stop her. Sherry Shepherd decided to embrace diabetes and use it as a motivator to improve her health. And she really has done a great job with that. And so I just want to say a lot of our patients may find diabetes discouraging, but some of them might actually make it a turnaround point in their life and say, you know what? I got this diabetes thing. I'm not going to let it take over my life. I'm going to take charge of my life and get to a better place of health. And I've seen that over and over again with patients I work with, that diabetes, getting diabetes was a moment where they really improved their health. So in the last 12 minutes, I just want to talk about two other types of diabetes, gestational and other types. And I want to say very clearly that I'm not going to talk enough about gestational diabetes. So I do have on the Level 2 online course series a whole program on women and diabetes that you can listen to. Or there's chapters in the book, Art and Science book, on gestational diabetes and diabetes and pregnancy that you could take a look at. So if you're not that comfortable with it, you want to read about it, because there are going to be questions on the exam about gestational diabetes. And as we go through these slides, I'll try and highlight some of the key things they're going to be asking you about gestational diabetes and diabetes and pregnancy. But I would like to launch another poll and ask you this following question. What best describes gestational diabetes? Is it diabetes discovered during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy? Is it diabetes discovered in the 24 to 28 week of pregnancy? Is it risk of getting diabetes before pregnancy? Or is it D, diabetes discovered at any point during pregnancy? All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. We've got a pretty big tie here with two of the answers. So think about, what is gestational diabetes? How is that discovered? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll, and we have slides coming up that go over this answer. But if you didn't know the right answer, it's okay. It just kind of points you in a direction, hey, maybe I need to study a little bit more about this. So nobody chose A, diabetes discovered within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. So this is a good point, because suppose a woman gets pregnant and she goes in and her provider says, let me just check your blood sugar. You have risk for diabetes. Let's just see what your blood sugar is. If she's discovered during the first 8 weeks of pregnancy, for example, that she has diabetes, it's called diabetes in pregnancy, or she just has type 2 diabetes and she's pregnant. That's what she would be. Okay, so that is not the right answer. The right answer, 55% of you chose that, was diabetes discovered during the 24 to 28 weeks of pregnancy. That is the right answer, because I just want to go down to D. So 45% of you chose D, diabetes discovered at any point during pregnancy. That's not accurate, because what if I go into my provider and I'm 8 weeks pregnant and they discover I have diabetes? That's not gestational diabetes. That's considered diabetes in pregnancy. It's treated differently. It's described differently. So that's a very important differentiation between the two. So B is the right answer, because B tells me my blood sugars were okay when I first got pregnant, but when they did the oral glucose tolerance test at my 24 weeks, they found out I was insulin resistant, there comes that word again, and I couldn't handle the blood sugars at that time. That's gestational diabetes. Let's go through some slides to clarify that a little bit more. So thank you for doing that, everybody. But I just want to say something really important, that gestational diabetes from a public health perspective is very important, because we know by helping women get to a healthy body weight before and during pregnancy, we can reduce the risk of gestational diabetes. The thing about it is, children born to women with GDM are at greater risk of diabetes, and a woman who has gestational diabetes is at greater risk for having diabetes in the future. So we really want to help women focus on prevention, keeping at a healthy body weight. And then here's that question we just went over. Gestational diabetes. So now you can see I have number 12. The number 12 indicates it's a standard of care. So if you want more information on gestational diabetes, you can go to the ADA Standards of Care number 12, and that's where you'll find a lot of this information I've gathered. It affects about 7% of all pregnancies, but look at this. There's been a 10 to 100% increase during the past 20 years. So it's really different ethnic groups are at higher risk for getting gestational diabetes. I have them listed here. Immediately after pregnancy, 5% to 10% of moms with GDM are diagnosed with type 2. Within 5 years, they have a 50% chance of developing diabetes. So we know this indicates a risk. We know if you get gestational diabetes, your pancreas isn't working right, you're more insulin resistant, and you're at very high risk for diabetes in the future. So we want to screen pregnant women before 13 weeks. We want to screen for undiagnosed type 2 at the first visit. So if a woman has any risk factors for type 2, we're going to screen and see what her blood sugars are. We want to catch diabetes early on if they have it. It's considered diabetes in pregnancy. That's their title. If normal, we recheck at 24 to 28 weeks. So we don't want the fetus to be exposed to any hyperglycemia in that first 12 weeks of development, because hyperglycemia during the first 12 weeks can lead to congenital defects. That's when all the organs are forming, especially the neurologic system, and it can cause a lot of neurologic problems. So management of diabetes in pregnancy, we want to provide preconception counseling and focus on the importance of getting that A1C below 7 before a woman moves into pregnancy. This is really important right here, the second bullet point. Avoid teratogenic meds, ACE inhibitor statins, and sexually active women not using reliable contraception. These medications can cause birth defects. So if a woman is type 2 and we have her on these medications, to manage her blood pressure and cholesterol, she needs to be using contraception. And if she's not using reliable contraception, we need to stop it because it can cause birth defects. Manage gestational diabetes with diet and exercise first, and then add medications if needed. The other thing about management of gestational diabetes and diabetes in pregnancy is women with pre-gestational diabetes, that means they had diabetes before they got pregnant, need baseline eye exam in first trimester and monitor every trimester, so frequent eye exams. A1C target during pregnancy, if less than 6 is the target, if it can be achieved without hypoglycemia. So we're really going to push these blood sugars close to normal range during pregnancy to protect the baby. Meds used in pregnancy include insulin, metformin, and glyburide. So insulin is FDA approved. Metformin and glyburide are category B. They seem safe. So the ADA is not wholly endorsing them, but this is the first time I've seen it included in their position statement. So they say, we might use these medications, but long-term safety data is still needed. Now you're going to ask me a really hard question. And you're going to say, Bev, what diagnostic criteria do we use to evaluate if they have gestational diabetes? Is it the 75 oral glucose tolerance test based on the HAPO study? Well, the ADA says you can use either one. We can use, but it's always at 24 to 28 weeks, we do an oral glucose tolerance test. And in this situation, it's 75 grams. And if one or more of the values met or exceed these listed here, that woman has gestational diabetes. But there's also a different way to do it. This is the NIH two-step. And you can see they use a 50-gram OGGT, non-fasting. And if the blood glucose is 140 at 1 hour, proceed to step two. And then we would do another, a larger glucose load, 100-gram oral glucose tolerance test. And if two or more of the values are met or exceeded, as listed down here, that is GDM. Now, there's still not agreement among these numbers. Here's Carpenter and Kustan, and here's NDDG. And so you can see that the providers use what's most comfortable for them. They can choose. So you might ask me, what do I study for the exam? I don't know if they would ask about this on the exam, but you might just want to be familiar with all of them in kind of a basic way. I don't know if I'd have all these numbers memorized, but you might want to know there's a one-step and there's a two-step. And one uses 75 and one uses, initially a 50. So I might just be familiar with that. Postpartum after gestational diabetes, these women, as I've mentioned, have a high risk of getting diabetes type 2 after delivery. So we want to screen them at 6 to 12 weeks postpartum and repeat at 3-year intervals. Encourage breastfeeding, weight control, exercise, and making sure they're connected with their healthcare team is really important. And the American Diabetes Association also says if a woman has prediabetes and a history of GDM, so let's say a woman had gestational diabetes, now she goes to her doctor and she has prediabetes, she should start metformin therapy because we know her risk is so high of moving on to diabetes. So this is really, really good to know. So that's a very brief review of gestational, and I want to wrap up with the one last type of diabetes. And that's other specific types. So we know there's type 1, type 2, gestational, and there was LADA in there that's kind of an in-between. But medications can certainly cause hyperglycemia. And the ones that I see the most are steroids, protease inhibitors, Prograf or medications used for transplant patients. And also I need to add to this, atypical antipsychotics like Zyprexa. Those can also really crank up blood sugars. But not in everybody. These medications actually are like a pancreatic stress test. They will show that the pancreas is not up to the job and it can't keep up with the insulin resistance caused by these medications. So, for example, I have a patient in the hospital, and there's two patients in a room. One goes on steroids, his blood sugars are normal. His roommate goes on steroids, his blood sugars are sky high. So it tells me that the person who has high blood sugars, he doesn't make enough insulin, and that's why the steroid has shown or revealed that the person either has diabetes or it has prediabetes and their pancreas can't handle that load. So these are other situations where the pancreas may not be able to manage and the blood sugars go up. But the main thing I want to say is regardless of cause, we need to treat it. We need to get those blood sugars to target. Online courses on the level 2, if you've signed up for those, we have a class on kids, older adults, and women. And so if you feel like that's an area you need more study, you can go to our online courses, or you can also look at our resources and think about, looking at that big book, The Art and Science. And so I think this is a natural place to conclude. I want to thank all of you for joining me on this first boot camp. It was a lot of information, and it's a lot of really important information that's going to set the foundation for the rest of the courses. And so this was really an important review. I want to thank you for your participation. And even though I'm going to press the stop recording button, I'm going to stay and answer any questions you might have. And if you have to go, that's okay. You can email me your questions, and I'll be happy to answer them. This is Beverly Tomasian, signing off.